Jim Caruso, good morning from California. How's New York?
New York is wet.
Well, we have our biggest guest yet. We're really excited today to have retired Admiral Harry Harris. He is also retired ambassador to Korea. Jim, why don't you go ahead and tell everyone about our guest?
I think you just did. Those are the two big factors. Admiral Harris was commander of Indo-PACOM. He was almost our boss in Australia till they pulled him from there and sent him off to Korea instead. And he's a great speaker, proponent of U.S. activity in the world, and someone who's going to answer the question we've been asking a lot of our guests, which is, Admiral Ambassador Harris, why should we have allies? We're a big, strong, powerful country. What's in it for us?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I had the opportunity to testify before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on that same issue, the issue of alliances, especially those in the Indo-Pacific. So alliances matter and allies matter. We do this because it makes us a stronger power to have allies that we can rely on and that they can rely on us. You know, if you look at the biggest alliance in the world, that would be NATO. It's 32 countries now. And Article 5 is that key part of the NATO alliance that says an attack on one is really an attack on all. And all members are obliged to help defend the country or countries that are also members that are attacked. Well, Article 5 in the 75-year history of NATO has only been called into play once, and that was on 9/11 or following 9/11 when the other NATO countries came to our aid militarily and joined us in the fight in Afghanistan. So that's just an example of the strength of alliances. We are stronger when we work together with our allies, rather than try to go it alone. You know, as you said, we're a big, powerful country, but there are some bigger issues out in the world today, and we see that play out in the headlines this very day. You know, you've got the Middle East, you've got Israel on Gaza, you've got the Houthis in the Red Sea, you've got China on Taiwan to worry about, you've got North Korea with its nuclear ambitions to worry about, and you've got Russia on Ukraine. So all of these issues we are helped in working through those issues and how those issues impact us. We are helped with our allies in the Indo-Pacific and in NATO.
Admiral, we're here talking mostly about the Indo-Pacific, and of course you are the commander of Indo-Pacific Command, and we see that our allies there are under a lot of strain recently. Of course, the Philippines has been very much in the news recently around a couple of the South China Sea features. But even just today, I woke up to news of an Australian naval helicopter being harassed. Flares were discharged right in front of it by a Chinese fighter aircraft. What is the state of our Indo-Pacific alliances, and are they more likely to sort of draw us into something, or are they more likely to help us?
Well, I mean. It's an important question. Let me tackle the bigger one first, and that is the United States has only 5 bilateral defense treaty alliances in the whole world, and they're all in the Indo-Pacific. That's Japan, South Korea, Australia, the Philippines, and Thailand. And those are our only bilateral defense treaties in the whole wide world. And we are obligated. Those treaties obligate us to do certain things in case those countries are attacked. But each treaty stands on its own, and each treaty is different. I believe that our willingness to defend those countries and our willingness to extend our nuclear deterrence to some of those countries acts as a deterrent to aggression against those countries. I mean, a typical example would be the Senkaku Islands, which are contested between Japan and the PRC. During the two administrations ago, it was made clear that even though we don't recognize this, who has sovereignty over the Senkakus, because it is a disputed territory, we recognize that Japan has administrative control over the Senkakus, and therefore we consider, for treaty purposes, the Senkakus to be part of Japan. So an attack on the Senkakus would be viewed the same as an attack on Tokyo. And I believe that that clear declaration of our view on the Senkakus has ratcheted down tensions on the Senkakus.
So does this mean we're sort of the cop on the beat in Asia, making sure the peace is kept?
No, I'm not a fan of that analogy, Jim, and I'll tell you why. Cops are great people, and they act out of a sense of altruism, right? They do what they do without adequate pay, adequate appreciation by the people that they protect. They're beleaguered a lot. They're protested against a lot, and so on. But they do this because they feel it's the right thing to do in order to have a better community or a better state or a better country. So my hat's off to them. But we enter into alliances not out of a sense of altruism. We enter into alliances because they make us stronger. We do it for our benefit as much as we do it for the benefit of the countries into which we enter an alliance. And that's why that cop on a beat analogy falls short with me.
You mentioned the deterrent value of our clarification of our treaty obligations regarding the Senkakus. We've made similar assurances to the Philippines, especially over the last year and a half, but we're going back to 2019. And yet the tensions around the West Philippine Sea seem to be going up and not down. Is there something different about that circumstance that makes that a less of a deterrent to that clarification?
Yeah. So the difference is that we don't recognize the territorial claims that the Philippines has, even though those claims are in the exclusive economic zone of the Philippines. And the ones that are in question in the present time are those at Scarborough Shoal and Second Thomas Shoal. So those islands are contested space, so we don't recognize the sovereignty of them, nor do we recognize any country's administrative control over them, unlike the Senkakus case with Japan. However, what we were clear in our declarations regarding the Philippines is that we extend our treaty with the Philippines to include Philippine military personnel wherever they might be. So on Second Thomas Shoal, there's an old World War II era tank landing ship that we gave to the Philippines at some point in time that they deliberately ran aground, and they keep people on that rusting hulk. And they have to be resupplied, and they have to be traded out over time. And so that's why you have all these resupply missions going between the Philippine mainland and the Second Thomas Shoal. And that's where our declaration, I believe, has prevented China from sinking any of those ships that are doing a resupply. They are harassing them for sure, and it's an indication of China's intent and disregard for international law, because in 2016, the International Tribunal on the Law of the Sea, the ITLOS Tribunal, ruled against China in favor of the Philippines. The Philippines brought the case to the tribunal, and the tribunal further ruled that China's 9-line claim in the South China Sea was without merit. And so China is disregarding international law. They're disregarding the UNCLOS treaty, a treaty to which they've signed on to. So our intent or our declaration has been to extend our treaty obligations, our defense treaty obligations to the Philippines to include Philippine troops wherever they might be.
So the situation there is they keep harassing these Philippine vessels. Some of them are military vessels. At what point does it switch over to harassment equals attack?
And then there are obligations. I mean, that's the call of the commanders on the ground, the Philippine government and the U.S. government.
So let's look at just I want to bring up Taiwan, because you had a lot to say about Taiwan in your Senate testimony. And one of those was that you would, first of all, that you would stop or change the historic strategic ambiguity policy that we have for Taiwan in exchange for strategic clarity. And you also mentioned in sort of in a separate breath that you were in favor of using the term adversary for China as opposed to competitor. What did you mean by strategic clarity, and why would you choose the word competitor to describe China?
So let me get into it with you on Taiwan first off. So in my opinion, Taiwan is democratic and a global force for good. They're an idea factory, and they are our friend. We're not obligated to defend Taiwan. What we are obligated to do is govern by the law. And the law is the 1979 Taiwan Relations Act. We celebrate the 45 years of that act this year, last month to be more precise in the time frame. So I believe that we owe a debt of gratitude to the 96th Congress, the Congress that was serving in the 1979 timeframe. They looked to the future and they crafted the Taiwan Relations Act, which obligates the United States to do certain things for Taiwan's defense. But defending Taiwan is not one of those things. But it means that we sell them equipment that they need to defend themselves and the like, and it makes a clear intent that we want a peaceful resolution of the Taiwan PRC issue, a peaceful resolution across the strait, the Taiwan Strait, and that we are opposed to a forceful reunification against the Taiwanese people's will. And that's kind of where we are with the law with regard to Taiwan. I believe that China's intent all along, PRC's intent all along, has been crystal clear. They want Taiwan, which they view as a renegade province, to come back into the family, if you will. And they want to do this peacefully, but they have been crystal clear they'll do it by force if necessary. And Xi Jinping has directed his military, the People's Liberation Army, and all its branches, the Air Force, the Navy, Rocket Forces, and all that. He's directed the PLA to be ready to take Taiwan back forcefully, militarily, by 2027. That's the end of his third term. I'm not sure what third term means if you're president for life, but that ends in 2027. So that's also the Davidson window, if you will. Admiral Davidson was my successor, and he said 2027, and that's become known as the Davidson window. Phil didn't mean to say that China, and he didn't say, actually, that China would attack Taiwan in 2027. He said that's the window, right? But it's been interpreted that in the media that Phil said that it would happen in 2027. That's not really what he said. But that's where the 2027 thing comes from. So China has been crystal clear with regard to what they are going to do if it doesn't happen peacefully. We, on the other hand, since 1979, we have had this policy of strategic clarity. Now, I will tell you, in my opinion, that policy has served us well for the past 45 years. But I think it is time to change the policy because we're facing a peer competitor, not a near peer competitor, but a peer competitor in China. And they have expressed clearly their intent. So here we are being ambiguous if we're going to defend Taiwan or not. That is no deterrent at all. What I told the Senate, and I've said this before, is I believe that we have three constituencies that we owe clarity to them, whether we're going to defend Taiwan or not. The first constituency is Taiwan itself. You know, they ought to be able to understand if we're going to defend them or not, so they can then make the decision that falls out from that determination. They can decide if we are clear that we're not going to defend them, then they can make the decision to arm up or capitulate to China. The second constituency is the Chinese people. They need to know the cost of invading Taiwan or trying to take Taiwan by force. Is the United States going to defend Taiwan? If the answer to that question is yes, they're going to lose hundreds of thousands of troops in that fight. And they ought to know that. And then they can then make the calculus whether it's worth it or not. But the most important constituency is the American people, because it's their daughters and sons that are going to do the fighting, and some are going to do the dying if we fight China over Taiwan. Now, the American people bought into this during the Cold War of the Soviet Union. And so the women and men who joined up knew that they might have to fight the Soviet Union if the Soviets invaded Western Europe. Their parents knew that that was a possibility for their children to fight and die in a hot war with the Soviet Union. But we don't have that clarity with regard to China. They ought to be told that. They ought to know that, you know, we're going to defend Taiwan, just as they know that we're going to defend NATO, we're going to defend Japan, we're going to defend South Korea, we're going to defend Australia, and on and on. So that's why I believe that this issue of strategic clarity versus strategic ambiguity is so important. Now, what's the second question?
Your recommendation that we start calling China an adversary as opposed to a competitor.
We ought to be honest with ourselves. You know, we have different branches of government that view China differently, even though, thankfully, today in 2024, we're coming together with a more unified view of the dangers from China than we were, say, a half dozen years ago when I was in uniform. But I view China as an adversary. For sure, it's a competitor, but Japan's a competitor, South Korea's a competitor, Australia's a competitor. You know, I mean, competitor. Friends can be competitors, but adversaries is a more focused term, and it doesn't try to gloss over how important this issue we have with China is, and why and it doesn't address the fundamentally different approaches to the world order that we have with China. And by the way, China is very clear in their own writings, translated for me because I don't speak or write Mandarin, that we are their adversary. And so here we are with words that mask, I think, our intent. And here we are, on the other hand, with China, with words that clearly define their intent.
So President Biden, I guess, four times now has said clearly that the U.S. would come to the aid of Taiwan, and the staff stopped walking it back. Do you think that is clear enough, or we need more?
Yeah, I think that our president is very clear, and that's a good thing. But what I'm worried about is when people that are either unelected or unconfirmed by the Senate walk back the leader elected by the American people, his intent. So I worry about that. But I'm glad that the president has said repeatedly that the U.S. will defend Taiwan. I think that helps immeasurably in the scheme of things in the Western Pacific.
Admiral, you were also ambassador to South Korea. We recently had a trilateral between the U.S., Japan, and South Korea. What do you think was important about that trilateral?
Well, the fact of it is probably the most important thing. But I'll also add that I think the President Yoon Suk-yeol, the current president in South Korea, and Prime Minister Kishida in Japan, they reflect statesmanship and action. You know, they are taking very unpopular positions in their countries, especially President Yoon and South Korea in their outreaches to each other. But despite that, they are doing what they believe is the right thing to do. And that is to move forward with the bilateral relationship between each other, despite opposition and just some really blistering poll numbers in their countries. So that's statesmanship in action. The trilateral is important because no security issue in the Western Pacific can be resolved without the active involvement of both Tokyo and Seoul and us, really. And so that's why the trilateral is important. And I'm excited by both it and the bilateral relationship. So in my day, we looked at our allies and partners in the region, and we were doing this hub, and we call it the hub and spoke. Reach out to one country, go out to another country, reach out to a third country, and on and on and on. It was a hub and spoke model. Well, what Indo-PACOM has done now, Admiral Aquilino, who just turned over last week, what their approach now is a more lattice-like approach with connections between countries and not us in the middle. So that now you have the trilateral with the United States, Japan, and South Korea. You have the trilateral between the United States, Japan, and the Philippines. We have the Quad, which is not a defense pact, but you have the Quad and you have AUKUS. So these are interesting things. I mean, you look at AUKUS, and there's Australia. You look at the Quad, and there's Australia. And you look at a trilateral between the U.S., Japan, and Australia. And you also look at Japan joining Pillar 2 of AUKUS, and maybe South Korea is next. So this is this lattice, this network of relationships between allies and partners that Indo-PACOM has gone forward with. And I wish it was my idea. But it's not. It's Lung Aquilino's and his team's idea, and my hat's off to them for thinking of it.
There's a lot of discussion of the uncertainty among our allies of our staying power, and that's abetted by Chinese propaganda, but also by some of the statements by our political leaders. And you see there's movement towards multilateral security arrangements, not including the U.S. Do you think this is a positive or is the concern?
Yeah. So, Jim, there's two parts to that question, right? So the second part of the question is I don't have a problem with, and I think it's a positive, if Japan has a relationship with Korea, a bilateral relationship with Korea, independent of us. There are different mechanisms already in place that have been in place for a long, long time. The FPDA, the Five Powers Defense Arrangement, is one of those. That doesn't include the U.S. That's fine. No issues with that. More power to them. And I think it helps in the rules-based order. To your former question, though, I am concerned about the partisan divisions that we see in Washington, and how that's interpreted by our friends, allies, partners, and others, not only in the Indo-Pacific, but globally. So I worry about that. And when our allies see this play out, then they do become worried about America's commitment to them. We see that in NATO, and we saw that in Korea and in Japan. And these countries are friends, are allies in some cases, partners in others. They start to hedge. And that's why, that's one of the reasons why you saw this uptick in Korean polling, that their people, the Koreans, believe that, one, we should return tactical nuclear weapons to the Korean Peninsula, we the United States, or two, Korea should pursue its own nuclear deterrent, because they were unconvinced that the United States would extend our nuclear deterrence to them. I believe that President Yoon's state visit to Washington last year helped allay those concerns. And the Washington Declaration, which was an outcome of the visit, the Washington Declaration on extended nuclear deterrence went a long way to quieting those voices. So they have to trust us, and we have to be relentless in our efforts to convince them of our seriousness of our treaty obligations, depending on the country, depending on the treaty and the like.
So, Admiral, we've talked about four of our five Indo-Pacific allies. And of course, those four, U.S., Australia, Japan, and the Philippines, have recently done some things together. They had a quadrilateral sail during the lead up into the Balikatan exercise. And then, of course, there was this remarkable meeting of the defense ministers in Honolulu just last week. We're talking about this lattice work, but there's one country that's sort of conspicuously absent in the lattice work. Is there something fundamentally different about our relationship, our alliance with Thailand, that doesn't sort of naturally draw them into this particular lattice work?
Yeah. So I haven't watched the Thai issue over the past couple of years since I retired from the military and then left the State Department. I've been focused more on Northeast Asia and the Philippines and Australia. Thailand is clearly hedging, in my opinion, though we still have a strong defense relationship with Thailand. Cobra Gold is one of those cases. I don't know. We'll have to see how that one plays out. Our treaty with Thailand is actually a remnant of the CETO alliance, right? The Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, which came about during the Vietnam era, and CETO collapsed on its own weight, but the part that remained, the remnant of it, was our defense treaty with Thailand.
Now, Ed, we also have partners throughout the region, all of ASEAN, who are not treaty allies, and we have keen interests there, and they are also hedging. So when you were commander at Indo-Pacific Command, how would you approach them in cooperating with us, since they were interested in working with us but not getting on the wrong side of China?
Yeah, so with regard to ASEAN, as the Indo-PACOM commander, I didn't have anything or much to do with ASEAN as an organization. So this is back to the hub and spoke thing. So we would work directly with the individual countries in ASEAN. The Philippines is one of those countries. We have a treaty with the Philippines, so we work with the Philippines. Singapore is a terrific partner. I used to characterize them as a partner that acts like an ally. So we work with the Singapore Armed Forces and their leadership in Singapore, and on and on. I was not allowed to work with Burma because while I was at Indo-Pakon, State Department wouldn't allow me to do that, which I thought was a mistake. But be that as it may, that's the way it was. So I did not work with Burma. I worked closely with Vietnam, and our relationship with Vietnam has only grown. It's a terrific partner. Their concerns are in many ways our concerns with regard to China and the South China Sea and China's illegal claims there. We have a terrific ambassador there, Mark Knapper. So, and Dan Krittenbrink, who was the ambassador, is now the assistant secretary for East Asia Pacific. So so those relationships are important. I think the most important thing that we must do, and we must continue to do, but we didn't do for a long time, is put ambassadors in these places that matter, right? And so I've always said, well, maybe I haven't always said it, but I've said it since I became one, that diplomats matter. Diplomacy matters. And so here we are. It took us 5 years, to get an ambassador in Singapore. We hadn't had one for 5 years until Ambassador Kaplan got there. It took us 5 years to get an ambassador to ASEAN. And here we are telling ASEAN that it matters and we believe in this concept of ASEAN centrality, but we don't have an ambassador there. Well, this is crazy, right? And so that's on us. And some of it isn't on the Senate, because it's easy to blame the Senate for not confirming ambassadors, but they can't confirm unless they have one nominated. So that's on the White House. So that's on us as a government when we delay so long in putting an ambassador in place in these countries, especially countries, one, that matter, and two, countries that are adversaries or strong competitors to us, which matter also, but for the opposite reason. So that's on us, and we have to do a better job. I'm glad that we have an ambassador in Singapore, an ambassador to ASEAN, and all of the other countries. You know, it took 18 months to get Phil Goldberg into Seoul behind me. 18 months, and he's been an ambassador already 4 times. He's a career ambassador in the State Department. How hard could that have been? But it still took 18 months. And I thought that the 16-month gap before I got there was too long. But, it took Phil 18 months. It took almost 2 years to get Carolyn Kennedy to Australia. And she's been an ambassador already. She's already been sent and confirmed. So this is on us as a nation, and we need to do better at that.
So, Admiral, you've been extraordinarily generous with your time this morning. I want to just sort of maybe wrap up with a question about India and the Quad. Yeah. And, when I first got to Australia and Jim was there and you were at Indo-PACOM, the Quad wasn't really a thing at the time. It was sort of an idea that had been around for a long time and was being pushed in various places. And, of course, Australia wasn't even sort of invited into the Malabar exercises at the time and with India and Japan and the U.S. So what has happened over the last few years to make the Quad sort of a reality? What is it now, and what do you think it can be?
Yeah, so what the Quad is, and again, that's Japan, the United States, Australia, and India. It's a grouping of like-minded democracies who view the world really through a similar lens. And it's not meant to be a defense pact. It's meant to be a force for good. The first big thing that they did together was COVID vaccine distribution. So that's ideal. But again, it's a grouping of like-minded democracies that view the challenges, opportunities, and dangers globally in general and in the Indo-Pacific in particular through a similar lens. So I called for its resurgence at the 2016 inaugural Raisina Dialogue. And I was ridiculed for it. You're absolutely right. I was ridiculed for that. The Washington Post criticized me for this crazy idea and this kind of thing. It had really fallen of its own weight. And I don't want to name names or countries back in 2008. And there was a lot of distrust between two of the countries, and that manifested itself from that period from 2008 until, you know, sometime later in the 2010s. So I call for its resurgence in 2016. I'm a believer in the Quad. I think it's important, and I'm happy to see that it's a thing now. I mean, I'm not suggesting that I had anything to do with that, other than I'm just happy to see it being where it is. And it takes leaders to do that. And when I say leaders, I mean the heads of government to do that. So when in 2021, I guess, you know, there was the leaders meeting. It was a virtual meeting because of COVID, but it was the heads of government got together and they had their leaders meeting. And that's what it takes. Now, I've called since then, I've called for a more formal way of looking at the Quad. So I've called for the establishment of a Quad secretariat headquartered somewhere in the region, certainly not in the United States, but somewhere in the region, to get at the issues, two issues really, to get at the issues of what issues to take on. So they took on COVID, which is a good thing, you know, but what issues should the leaders take on with this grouping of like-minded democracies? And the second issue, though, is how do new members get to be members of the Quad, right? So I was asked frequently in Korea, how come we can't be in the Quad, or how can we get in the Quad? You know, I don't know. I mean, you know, who's in charge? There's no Quad country that's the head of the Quad. It doesn't have a rotational thing like the Security Council or anything like that. It just is what it is. So I used to joke that back in the day, the Big Ten had 14 teams and the Big 12 had 10 teams. So there's nothing that says the Quad has to have only four teams. Now, of course, now both the Big Ten and the Big 12, I think, have 14 teams each. Even better, there's nothing that says the Quad has to be limited to four teams. But we have to have a mechanism to embrace new members. I don't know how to do that. So other than to have a secretariat, and then that would be one of the issues that the four leaders would discuss and move forward on.
Well, Harry Harris, you have been extraordinarily, as I said, generous with your time. I know you're extremely busy, and you've graced our little podcast with a great tour de force of the entire region. I leave you with any final words.
No, I don't have anything to say other than I applaud you both for this initiative to get this podcast out there and wish you the best in your endeavors.
You're very kind, sir.
Thank you very much, Admiral.
Jim, that was really exciting. That was great to see Admiral Harris again. I think I mentioned to you before, and actually I mentioned to him, that the last time I saw him, I had appeared in his office to sort of, he was coming to Australia and I was going to kind of give him a rundown on his Australia ambassadorship. And of course, he never got there.
Right. Now, I was the acting ambassador and he had been nominated and actually had been confirmed. He and his wife came down for a tour of the ambassador's residence. And Australia, after having not had an ambassador, just me pretending for about 2 years, they were very pleased to have someone, especially someone like Harry Harris, who is extremely well respected. As you heard from his talk just now, he's straightforward, honest, funny. He would have been perfect.
I remember when I was there that I constantly was getting sort of, you know, excited interactions with various of my counterparts who were so excited that the former commander of Indo-Pacific Command was going to come to be, you know, somebody of that stature was going to become the U.S. ambassador to Australia. And it was seen as a sign of the U.S. commitment to the alliance. It was seen as a sign of how seriously we were taking the alliance. Of course, he had a lot of respect in Australia. It was one of those things that it's almost like we couldn't get him there fast enough.
Right. And if you remember also, this was during the Trump administration, and there was a lot of concern about what alliances meant to the Trump administration. And so this was a reassurance for the Australian government that, okay, this alliance is on sound footing. And the day after he was confirmed, he was pulled from Australia and going to be sent to South Korea, where we also didn't have an ambassador. And the reasoning was because this was going to be on the eve of the summit between Kim Il-sung and President Trump. And we needed an ambassador in South Korea to help reassure them that no deal was going to be done behind their back. Nevertheless, the Australians were extremely upset. I got calls up and down the line. I had to appear on TV shows to explain this is not an insult. And what I kept saying was, is it more important right now for this Harry Harris, who you admire so much, to be dealing with Korea and summits between the leader of North Korea and the United States, or to come here? And their response was, that's all well and good, but you're telling us in the country of 370 million people, he's the only one? To which I said, yes. it was tough. And one senior person literally took me to the lapels and asked me what the bleep we were doing. it was an exciting day.
Well, we're gonna let that one stand as your "there I was" moment, being taken by the lapels by a senior Australian official. And I mean, he did get to Korea at just it was a really sort of remarkable time. We had these this first ever summit between President Trump and Kim Jong Un, and then we sort of. Of course, there were all of these missiles being fired. And so, you know, obviously that was a strategic decision by the government to put him there at that particular time. But you actually sort of hit on it in our discussion with him that it was also, kind of a testy time because President Trump had been making noises about maybe pulling troops out of South Korea.
Right, pulling out troops out. Saying the Koreans were shortchanging us on the cost of basing the troops there, and in fact, holding this summit with the North Korean leader without really coordinating with South Korea. So it was a tough diplomatic job that Ambassador Harris had to deal with. And of course, I misspoke about the name of the leader.
I mean, I think this is a very timely podcast for us because, of course, we're going into an election season, and there former President Trump is one of the candidates running and has a pretty good chance of being the next president again. And there are questions about U.S. commitment to alliances. And what I generally will tell my friends in Asia when I'm asked is, despite the rhetoric, actually alliances did pretty well during the first Trump administration. So, I'm an optimist, but I tend to think that that's probably going to be the case again, just because the logic for alliances, as was clearly sort of spelled out by Admiral Harris, is so overwhelmingly compelling. I mean, it's just, they do so much for our posture in the region, for stabilizing an important region of the world. And, as a deterrent to China's adventurism at this point in time, you really wouldn't want to have those undermined or weakened in any way.
I agree with you, Ray, but there is a cycle to history, and we seem to be in the cycle leading towards neo-isolationism. The world being difficult and complex, a lot of Americans say, just pull up the drawbridges, let the rest of the world go to hell, we'll take care of ourselves. And then, of course, it's a small place, this world. We can't really accomplish what we'd hope to accomplish that way.
Well, and of course, neo-isolationism did not serve us especially well in the lead up to the catastrophic World War II, and arguably served as sort of the opposite or an encouragement rather than a deterrent to Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan.
Well, here's hoping for the best, Ray.
All right, Jim, on that happy note, We will go ahead and close this one out. This has been Why Should We Care About America's Indo-Pacific Allies with Admiral Harry Harris. And we are excited to finish this one and look forward to putting it out. If you do listen to this podcast, we encourage you to listen to our other ones. You can either get them on one of your favorite podcast streaming service or on YouTube. Just look for Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific. Thanks. Until next time, Jim, farewell.